Jobless claims head in the right direction.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media in Los Angeles, welcome to the Morning Open. I'm Bob Moonen for Bill Radke. And there's encouraging news at this hour on the jobs front. About 11,000 fewer Americans filed claims for unemployment benefits last week, the second straight week of declines. We'll check out what that might mean to the bigger economic picture in a moment. But first, where's Wall Street? Color early traders reassure the Dow Industrials have climbed 73 points so far to 11,118. The S&P 500 and NASDAQ are ahead by similar margins, around 0.75%. So, jobless claims drop for the second straight week, falling below 450,000. To help us sort out what that means, we turn live now to Diane Swonk, chief economist at Mesirow Financial. Diane, I saw one headline a few minutes ago that suggested this was not quite as good as expectations, and it said that underscores a fragile labor market. Would you concur or no?
Absolutely. What we're seeing is layoffs are abating, but we've yet to really see hiring pick up. And in fact, we really need to see jobless claims around the 400,000 threshold to feel like we're seeing a meaningful pickup in employment out there. And employment at the end of the day is the key to a self-feeding recovery.
Well, as I mentioned, though, they're heading in the right direction. What about this momentum?
We are seeing them head in the right direction, although not as quickly as we'd like to see that happen. It really confirms that the overall job market is slow to heal. And in fact, the pain that's been felt on Main Street is going to linger for some time now.
And speaking about lingering pain, what about the lingering money worries over in Europe? How much could that affect us?
Very important. We can't afford to have any more big failures, whether it be a country or a company at this stage of the game. And we're still a very fragile healing system in our financial markets. And the last thing we need is another financial crisis so early into a fragile recovery.
Diane Swonk, chief economist at Mesirow Financial, thanks very much for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
The Senate finally begins debate on new rules for Wall Street today. Republicans ended their filibuster yesterday, agreeing to allow debate to begin on the final overhaul legislation. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer joins us live now from Washington. Good morning, Nancy.
Good morning, Bob.
And what did Republicans get in return for stopping their filibuster?
Well, for one thing, they got some sleep. Reuters says an agreement between the two sides was announced last night, just minutes after an aide said cots would be set up for senators to sleep on. But as far as the bill goes, Democrats agreed to drop plans for a $50 billion fund that would be used to unwind large failing banks.
Well, with that fund gone, is there anything in this bill now that deals with this too big to fail question?
Yes. The bill would set up a council that would monitor the economy for threats or bubbles. And if it got permission from the council, the Federal Reserve could break up big failing financial institutions. I talked to William Tartikoff about this. He's general counsel for the Calvert Group, an investment advisory firm.
Some part of the government needs to have a window to come in and determine what is best and not leave it up to the banks just to fend for themselves and do what they think is in their best interest.
Now, Bob, the debate is expected to last a couple of weeks. Both Republicans and Democrats are planning hundreds of amendments, and Republicans could threaten more filibusters.
A couple of weeks sounds like they've got a lot of areas of disagreement to work out here at this point. What are those?
Yeah, they do. Well, the main one is what form a proposed Consumer Protection Bureau should take. Right now, it would be inside the Fed. Democrats had wanted a standalone agency. Republicans are worried the proposed bureau would be too far-reaching.
Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer in Washington. Thank you. You're listening to the Morning Report for Thursday, April 29th at marketplace.org. Hey, you want $8,000? Better move fast. The clock is ticking. The government tax credit for new home buyers expires Friday at midnight. Nearly 2 million people have already taken advantage of the program. But has the program really helped revive the housing market? Marketplace's Brett Neely takes a look.
Consumers think so. A new survey by Prudential Real Estate says the vast majority believe the tax credit has helped turn around the U.S. housing market. Jim Malozzi is the company's CEO.
We're thankful the government did it. It helped bridge a
difficult period for American consumers.
Columbia University economist Chris Mayer says it was more of a giveaway. He says most home buyers probably would have bought anyway. The credit just gave them a reason to buy sooner rather than later.
You know, given that this cost us $12 billion, I think it was a pretty big cost for a program that had at best pretty moderate or small effects.
Mayer says don't thank the tax credit for stabilizing the housing market.
The single biggest thing that affected the housing market was the Fed's policy to bring down mortgage rates.
But those rates are rising, which Mayer says could pour cold water on the market later this year. I'm Brett Neely for Marketplace.
Please remain seated for the duration of your ordeal. But start your watches, because starting today, any airline that leaves passengers waiting on the tarmac for more than 3 hours can be fined more than $25,000 a passenger. The regulations meant to halt hostage-like ordeals that have kept passengers cooped up as long as 10 hours. But as Marketplace's Elisa Roth tells us, some aviation experts are warning the new rule could bring on new headaches.
It doesn't matter if the problem's the weather, a mechanical issue, or just plain old delays. If passengers are stuck on a plane for more than 2 hours, the airline has to provide food and drinks. And if the delay's longer than 3 hours, the airline has to let passengers off the plane. This is all meant to protect the passengers. But Roger King, an airline analyst at Credit Sites, says it's an absurd solution, because airlines would rather cancel flights than risk the fine. And he says cancellations are where the hassles really start.
Anytime a flight's canceled, not only does it, you know, screw up people trying to get booked on other flights that are all pretty much filled up, but wherever the plane's headed, you know, it affects their flights too.
He says marathon delays like the ones that prompted this rule are actually pretty uncommon. They just generate a lot of chatter and bad publicity. He says a smarter solution would be a way for airplanes to jump back into the takeoff queue once the problem that was causing the delay cleared up. Mike Boyd runs an airline consulting business in Colorado. He says the rule is the government's cheap answer to a much bigger problem. The air traffic control system is inadequate.
We have an air traffic control system that cannot handle weather as well as it should because it's out of date. Therefore, if you have a line of thunderstorms, airplanes can't go through it because we don't have the equipment to do it, and airplanes will divert or just be late.
Both he and King say claims this rule could push pilots to cut corners on safety are patently ridiculous, but that passengers could start seeing the effect of skittish airlines almost immediately. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Time to go back to school, actually graduate school. A report out today says more jobs will require an advanced degree in the future. The study is from the Council of Graduate Schools and Educational Testing Service. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more.
The report says by the end of the decade, nearly 20% more jobs will require a master's or PhD. David Payne of Educational Testing Service says deliver those degrees or the economy will stagnate.
While it used to be that there were lots of career opportunities for people with high school education or with bachelor's degrees, we're seeing that in order to contribute to this knowledge-based economy, students really do need to get advanced training.
But the report says graduation rates are low for PhDs and few minority students go beyond an undergraduate education. More government funding of students and university programs would help, says Payne. Otherwise, the U.S. will fall behind.
In countries such as China and India and the EU, governments are putting significant amounts of money and resources into beefing up and bolstering their graduate and research enterprises.
The report says businesses also have a role to play by offering more internships and training opportunities. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
In a week's time, Britain votes in a general election. Opinion polls indicate public support is pretty evenly divided between the Labour Party, which has held office for 13 years, and the opposition Conservatives and Liberal Democrats. Unlike the U.S., Britain bans political advertising on TV, so politicians have to resort to more traditional methods. Christopher Worth reports from London.
This is supposed to be the UK's first digital election. No one had even heard of Facebook or Twitter the last time the Brits voted in 2005. But as opinion polls have narrowed, the good old-fashioned political campaign poster is back and being used to full effect.
It's the one area of political campaigning in this country when we see the teeth bared and the blood dripping from their mouths as they really have a go at each other.
Paul Bainsfair is with Iris, a company that's designing posters for the UK's third largest party, the Liberal Democrats. He says campaign posters have a long tradition in British politics. Right now, the Conservative Party is blitzing the UK with billboards that lampoon Prime Minister Gordon Brown's handling of the economy over the past 13 years.
Big headlines saying things like, I sold all of Britain's gold reserves, vote for me.
But Brown's Labour Party warns that the budget cuts the Conservative leader David Cameron is proposing will jeopardize the economic recovery. Nicholas O'Shaughnessy is an expert in political marketing at Queen Mary, University of London. He says for political parties, unveiling a new poster is a good way to get onto the evening television news.
The poster is immensely economic because it's replicated by the mass media. The newspapers print the posters as a news item, and so you get a lot of bang for the buck.
He says that kind of media publicity alone can add up to about $3 million worth of free campaign advertising. But as new media expert Clifford Singer has shown, in the age of the internet, the message of posters can be easily turned against the party that's putting them out there. Earlier this year, he launched MyDavidCameron.com, a website that allows visitors to create spoof versions making fun of the Conservative Party's original posters and have everyone see them online.
Within a week, we had tens of thousands of visitors, and hundreds of people were making their own posters and sending them around on Facebook and Twitter and other social media.
And the Conservative Party started its own website, parroting the Labour Party's posters. So this really is the UK's first digital election, just not the one politicians were expecting. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
What's black and white and covered with health warnings? Cigarettes. That is, if the Australian government has its way, it's introduced legislation that would ban colorful images and logos from cigarette packs. For Marketplace, the BBC's Sarah Garathy reports from Sydney.
Pick up a pack of cigarettes in Australia and you'll be faced with graphic photos of mouth cancer and rotting teeth. What could be more grotesque than that? Well, if you're a tobacco company, maybe a simple, boring white pack. The plan is to make smoking even less attractive, especially to young people. Professor Simon Chapman is advising the government on how to do it.
It removes completely the ability of the tobacco industry to effectively say anything about its brands other than the name of the brand.
The US limits advertising with packs carrying a small warning that smoking may kill you, but Australia's will be the boldest cigarette advertising crackdown by any country, and the companies are already threatening legal action. Tim Wilson's from the Australian think tank, the Institute of Public Affairs.
The tobacco companies may be able to sue the government for the compensation for the loss of their trademarks and may seek compensation of up to $3 billion per annum.
If the Australian government succeeds in court, other countries could follow suit. In Sydney, I'm the BBC's Sarah Garathy for Marketplace.
The oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico is already one of the largest in U.S. history, and it's getting worse. The U.S. Coast Guard late yesterday announced the damaged well is leaking 5,000 barrels of oil a day. It had been saying 1,000. BP says it welcomes military aid to help with the cleanup. From London, Stephen Beard reports on the costs.
BP says it's spending $6 million a day trying to clean up the spill and stop the leak. Those costs can quickly add up. A comparable spill off the coast of Australia took a month to get under control. That would set BP back more than $160 million. The company is getting some help from a surprising source. Rival oil giant Shell has sent half a dozen vessels to help with the cleanup. Nick McGregor is with brokers Redmayne Bentley. He says both companies drill in deep water, both have much at stake.
As companies like BP and Shell highlight that their speciality is the tough-to-reach resources, what they also have to highlight is that they can manage that process in a safe and secure fashion. Otherwise, they're going to find the political will to grant exploration licenses just isn't there.
The slick in the Gulf of Mexico is now 600 miles in circumference and is expected to hit the Louisiana coastline by Friday night. In London, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
And finally, I couldn't resist trying to milk this story I spotted this morning from the National Milk Producers Federation. The dairy group is renewing a campaign it tried unsuccessfully 10 years ago. They want to reserve the name of their product to what they define as any of the various mammalian lacteal secretions. In other words, cow's milk or goat's milk or sheep's milk. just not soy milk or rice milk or other plant-based beverages that the milk producers insist should be labeled something else, or at the very least, imitation milk. They're pushing the request with the Food and Drug Administration and taking aim at makers of non-dairy drinks with a Facebook page called They Don't Got Milk. And you learn something new every day. When I was reading this article, I never realized that there's something called hemp milk. And no, I wasn't hallucinating. We always welcome your thoughts at marketplace.org. I'm Bob Moon in Los Angeles. This is the Marketplace Morning Report.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.